Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. This week we are looking at a piece of writing that is both incendiary and important about the horrid state of pro men's soccer in the United States. But it's not just a critique. It is a roadmap so that really directs us in a way that we can envision the ways that the United States could not only be home to a top professional soccer league, but also ascendant on the global scene. It is a call to action. The book is called The Football Manifesto and Club Handbook, Bringing the Beautiful Game to the People and Making the USA Number One in the World. We have the author. The book is available anywhere you look online. I recommend you getting it. And hopefully after we speak, you're going to understand even more why this should be on your shelf. His name, the author, is Robert Wilson, and we're thrilled to have him on the show from Rio. Welcome, Robert. Thank you so much for joining us.
Dave, glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm thrilled. First, you know, I do want to dive into the book big time, but, you know, for my audience, I've known that they really like to know a little bit about who I'm speaking to and their own roots. And so I'd love it if you could speak about who you are, where your soccer fan comes from, and also what living in Rio has taught you about the beautiful game.
Well, I grew up in the States. I'm from St. Louis. Like most kids that grew up in an inner city neighborhood, I played baseball, basketball, and American football. But St. Louis was a unique place because it's certainly then was a strong Catholic city. And because of the Catholic sports scene in the schools from K through 12 and actually all into St. Louis University, which is a Catholic university, soccer was a major sport covered in the newspapers in St. Louis, along with basketball, baseball, and American football. So I grew up with the sport in the newspapers, but that game didn't penetrate the inner city. So I never played the game in the inner city. But I didn't really get to know the sport until I came to Brazil and went to college, went to law school. And I'm taking a very long story short about how I got to Brazil. When I got here, it was the late 70s. It was still a military dictatorship. And it was an amazing period of time. I mean, obviously, the dictatorship is the dictatorship. That's a separate conversation for a separate podcast. But I began going to the games in Rio at Maracanã. And
I'm sorry, real quick to interrupt. For my listeners, that is arguably the most revered soccer stadium on the face of the earth in Rio, the Maracanã. Please continue.
Yeah, I should also tell your audience that it's not what it used to be. When they reformed it for the World Cup, it was a dramatic reform. And so I've been at Maracanã. Amazingly enough, when there were 182,000 people in the stands. And it's just hard to describe the vibration, that you get from a game and that kind of crowd. I hate to say it, but the stadium today is really a stadium for the bourgeoisie. And in those days, it was like, if any way you could describe it, it's a proletarian stadium. Everybody from the masses of society went to Maracanã. Ticket prices were totally affordable. And now it's pricey to get into the games. So it's a much more elitist sport than it was, let's say, 30, 40 years ago.
I mean,
having said that, that was my first, kind of introduction to the game.
Sorry. I have so much to ask you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was an amazing experience. I mean, I grew up in the States. I was a sports fanatic growing up in the States. Loved sports, played sports in high school, played sports in college. So, it was a very serious part of my life. But until I got to Brazil, I did not realize the depth and breadth of what a football culture means. So the connections that you make with a club, and of course with the people that support that club. So for here in Rio, for instance, I'm a member of the Flamengo Club. Now, it turns out today Flamengo is, I think it's safe to say, the most powerful football team in Latin America. This past year, they generated in local currency R1.5 billion. Now, when you transfer it back on an FX basis, on a foreign exchange basis to the dollar, it's somewhere around $300 million. But still, that's a decent amount of revenue, even in dollars. And to give you to kind of proportion it, this year, that amount of revenue for one club was the equivalent of the entire Argentinian first division. So Brazil is distancing itself from the rest of Latin America, in part because of the infrastructure that they created for the World Cup in 2014, but also just because of the size of the economy, and things are reverberating in terms of the other clubs as well. So that's changing the landscape for football in Latin America. And it hasn't really changed and had repercussions outside of Brazil, because Brazil is still a net exporter of talent in terms of Europe and that kind of thing. But it was an incredible experience to join that club, to support that club in the stands. And to give you an idea of what Flamengo means here, Flamengo is a multi-sport club, which means, obviously, I'm going to say football when I mean soccer. So football is the dominant sport at Flamengo, but they also field teams in basketball, volleyball, Olympic swimming, judo, gymnastics, rowing, and there are other, as tennis. I mean, there are all other sports at the club that you can literally frequent from kids to adults for a monthly fee. That concept of a club, which is kind of like a branded version of the YMCA or possibly the YWCA, doesn't really exist in the States. And we've got this notion of the Green Bay Packers, and there are a few other, quote unquote, fan-owned clubs in the United States. But really, that kind of club where you can pay a monthly dues and literally go there and work out, take your kids and family there for lunch, and just hang out, as a social club in an urban setting, doesn't exist. And that's really the idea I'm trying to bring to the States.
Yes, I love that segue. Let's get to the football manifesto. I think the starting point for many U.S. men's soccer fans is we are a country of over 300 million people. We are increasingly an immigrant population from soccer-mad parts of the world, but USA soccer is a disaster and we never get anywhere in the World Cup. I want you to answer that question, Robert. Why is that the state of affairs?
Well, let me qualify my answer by saying the women are world class. And the women, as you know, do win at the Olympics and in World Cups for women. However, it's the men's game that the book was really about. Right now, the women really are the only global standard of excellence that the United States has. The men, on the other hand, is a really, really strange story. And from 2014 until 2018, I kept a blog that basically was a blog about football in Latin America and North America. I mean, I brought in some other thoughts about football in Europe as well. But eventually, I started to ask myself a question: why is it that the United States has four dominant professional sports leagues in the NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, and the NHL, which are literally the standard of global excellence for those sports? Why couldn't the United States do the same thing for football? I mean, what's holding them back? And initially, I didn't get any real solid answers. But once I started digging, and the digging took literally 4 years, it became clear that there was something going on that from a business perspective didn't make any sense. And I have to admit that there were some sources that, you know, required that I not reveal names, so that's fine. But the book's conclusion is that what's happening with Major League Soccer and with U.S. soccer in the United States is not an accident. It's quite planned and structured and has been planned and structured since the inception of the league in 1996. Basically, the idea that the book concludes is that 30 years ago, some of the NFL owners clearly saw the demographic changes in the United States.
Can I interrupt you? I really want to put a fine point on this for the listeners. The invention of the National Football League and the owners of the National Football League are a key part of your argument about why soccer has not flourished in this country. Sorry, please continue.
Yes, that's exactly right. And they saw the demographic changes, which you mentioned earlier on, that the country was basically migrating into a direction where the incoming immigrants and the existing immigrant populations that we have together would create literally a substantial catchment area of potential supporters for the sport, and that that was a threat to the NFL. But why was it a threat to the NFL? Because the NFL's pipeline of talent into the NFL is 75% Black. The players in the NFL are 75% Black people from the inner city. And they looked at this sport and thought, Jesus, if football ever got traction in the United States and began paying world-class wages and promoting the game to be on a par with, say, the English Premier League or the German Bundesliga, and they were paying wages that competed with Europe, there would be for sure a migration of some of that pipeline of talent out of the inner city and into football as opposed to American football. And so they say, well, why not control this thing from day one? Why not structure it? So we structured it as a they structured it as a single entity. That was not a mistake. And they also created something called weighted voting inside U.S. soccer, so that the professional league that Don Garber now leads became disproportionately weighty in the voting at U.S. soccer, which is FIFA's representative in the United States. And when you add in the structuring that went on with the league and the key people that were put in positions of decision-making and power at both U.S. soccer and Major League Soccer, it was a perfect storm to do exactly what the NFL owners wanted to do, which is to keep the sport largely tamped down. And the best proof of that is the salary cap. So the salary cap in 1996 was $1.96 million per team. You know, team is usually 25 players, right? Today, this is 30 years later, the salary cap is more than quote-unquote 5 million per team. So it's still unbelievably low. And to give you an idea, the NFL salary cap in 1996 was $40 million. The NFL salary cap for the 24-25 season is going to be $280 million. The competition is just unbelievable. I mean, there's, you know, there is no competition, right? And that's exactly what they wanted.
Now, I was hoping you could connect the dots a little bit more with NFL owners and their intervention in this process, because you're very pointed to say NFL and not say Major League Baseball worried about the competition, or hockey worried about the competition, the NBA worried about the competition. There's a focus on the NFL, and I could see why the NFL would be more anxious than these other leagues, because it is so provincial in terms of the United States and does not have the global reach of those other sports for profit revenue. But maybe you could connect the dots a little bit about the NFL people who've intervened into this process.
Yeah, so the league was started, again, in 1996 by a number of investors, but the key drivers were Lamar Hunt and Robert Kraft. Now, Mr. Hunt has passed away since then, so it's the Hunt family now. And at a period of time early on in the league's existence, Phil Anschutz came in as an owner. And there was a period of time when there were 10 teams in the league. And at that period of time, Phil Anschutz was the leading candidate for an NFL franchise in Los Angeles. Now, you know, people don't talk about that, but basically you had three people who controlled the entire professional sport in the United States. Anschutz had six teams. Hunt had two and Kraft had one, to the best of my recollection. Now, they structured the league the way they thought was best to be structured for them to maintain control. When I say the NFL owners, obviously, you know, Hunt and Kraft are clearly the two leading, quote unquote, investors in the league MLS, from not just the standpoint of financials, but in terms of their clout and wherewithal in terms of the direction of the league. Sometime around 1999, after the league had been in existence for a couple of years, Kraft approached Don Garber, who was then the head of NFL Europe, and asked Garber whether he would come on board to lead MLS as commissioner. And so Don Garber has been commissioner of MLS since 1999. And in parallel with that was a gentleman named Sunil Gulati,
sure,
who came on for a while as kind of like the number two guy at MLS. But Sunil Gulati also had a relationship with Robert Kraft. Eventually, he became the head of something called Kraft Soccer while he was also holding a position at MLS, and also while he was at U.S. Soccer. Eventually, he became president of U.S. Soccer for, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 12 years. So there were some conflicts of interest. That's fine. But the fact of the matter is that people were put in position that could be trusted from the standpoint of the two drivers of the league, namely Hunt and Kraft. And as a result, the league became structured in a way, and U.S. soccer became structured in a way that, for all practical purposes, without their fingerprints obviously on the quote-unquote issue, the NFL was basically guiding the development of the sport in the United States without having their name anywhere associated with it, because it had representatives doing it for them. Now, you know, all of this is detailed in the book.
I'm sorry.
Obviously,
I'd like to come in for my audience just so they know. Philip Anschutz is also one of the great underwriters of the right wing in terms of think tanks and infrastructure in the United States. And the Lamar Hunt you mentioned, who passed away, is the son of H.L. Hunt, one of the great underwriters of the right wing and the even like the far right wing in the United States. And both made their money in oil, gas, and fossil fuels. Make of that
what
you will.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I don't need to go into the details of, you know, where the NFL owners are politically. We know where they are politically, right? I mean, you know, they're all basically right where they want to be, particularly with Trump in the White House. But having said that, I think the real kind of question that I have in my mind, which is just like mind-boggling, because it's a philosophical question. How did this happen without the mainstream media picking up on it? You know, I mean, why isn't this common knowledge? I mean, all of the stuff that I'm talking about, except for a few sources, is public information. And so the question is, how does it happen that this kind of what amounts to be a coup d'etat in sports, how could this take place? How did it happen in plain view? You know, I still don't really have an answer to that question, except to say that, you know, the media and sports generally in the United States is a form of religion, you know. And as much as we don't want to admit it, it in some sense is a form of addiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are massively addicted to sports in the United States, and probably no sport is more addictive than the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
You know, And so the NFL gets quite a bit of scrutiny. It has a machine behind it that is so strong that despite the scandals, despite the drugs, despite the violence, both on the field and off, they have somehow been able to weather the storm. And needless to say, they make a lot of money. I mean, this coming season, the average NFL team will bring in $400 million in revenue. You've got a payroll of 280. I mean, they're making money hand over fist.
The former union leader of the NFL, Eric Winston, he used to say that being an NFL owner is like being a bartender on spring break. You don't have to be good at it to make a ton of money.
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, it's a juggernaut, And so after having written the book, I started, finding out what other leagues around the world did to try to establish themselves. And probably the league that gave me the most inspiration to write the book, which I did not put into the book, is the J League in Japan. Now, I don't know if you've heard this story, but it's a great story. I had a friend from Brazil who was living in Japan at the period of time that J League was formed, and he told me the following story. In 1990, some Japanese businessmen, C-suite types, high up in the corporate hierarchy, took a joint trip to Italy for the 1990 World Cup. And they were totally blown away by the World Cup. It wasn't a particularly exciting World Cup by World Cup standards, but Maradona was in the final, et cetera, et cetera. So they went back to Japan and they wrote a letter to João Havelange, who was then the president of FIFA, and said, "We'd like to bring the World Cup to Japan." And Havelange wrote back and said, "Well, we would love to take the World Cup to Asia, but you don't have a professional league. So until you have a professional league, we really can't consider it." Now, this is 1991. They decided to hire Sony's design department. One of the guys that went to Italy was from Sony. They hired their design department and they literally invented from whole cloth 10 teams. They came up with their names, they drew the mascots and the logos and the team colors and the uniforms, and they went to a Japanese sports apparel company, produced all the quote unquote information for kits and merchandising, and began selling kits and merchandise for this imaginary league in 1991 with the promise that the league eventually would exist. Now, it took them 2 years to get the league off the ground, but from 1991 to 1993, they sold $200 million worth of merchandise in the Sony retail store network in Japan. And my friend is telling me the story. He says, "Well, look, that's not the best part of the story. The best part of the story is that all of the sales were walk-in sales. There was no internet." So I'm thinking, gee, that's like really fascinating. What about doing something like that in the States? And so when you look at the landscape today, if you follow Twitter at all, or some of the other, social media platforms, there is a real debate in the United States today about MLS as a league and the quote unquote monopoly that it has.
Yes, because one of your positions is that to make soccer work in the United States, we actually need to scrap MLS. It can't be reformed and actually start something new from scratch. And I feel like you're saying that Japan laid out a model for how we could initially do that.
Yeah, initially is the key word because I think the question is, how do you take this game to the untapped grassroots in the United States that supports the sport? So, for instance, in 1990, the population in the United States was 250 million, right? This is 6 years before the start of MLS, 4 years before the World Cup in 1994 in the United States. The population of the United States today is 340 million. So that 90 million population increase, right, is basically the size of Germany. The United States today basically has four Germanys floating around, right? Total population. But in terms of fans of the sport of football, it's probably around 110 to 120 million fans. Those fans don't spend their money on Major League Baseball or basketball or the NFL or hockey. They basically watch the sport either following the Mexican LX League or European leagues. They don't spend their money for MLS. So the question is, how do you tap into that? And I think the way you tap into it is by bringing the Bundesliga model to the United States. And I think you can do that with technology.
Explain.
So that's So here's the Bundesliga is the most unique league, I would say, today on the planet, because it has regulations that require that the clubs in the league be fan-owned and controlled. So, for instance, the one that we know the most about is Bayern Munich. Bayern Munich is 75% owned by the fans and 25% owned by Audi, Allianz Insurance, and Adidas. Each one has 8.3%. But they have rules that say you have to have a professional management team that runs the professional club that plays on TV that we see all the time. But the remainder of the club is really a not-for-profit. They have other sports there besides football. And they have 360,000 monthly dues-paying members. And so, you know, those dues-paying members in part support the club. Now, obviously, that's not the only revenue that the club has. But Barcelona, along with Bayern Munich and Real Madrid, are two of the top, or I should say three of the top 10 clubs in the world that are fan-owned and controlled. Mm-hmm. And Real Madrid actually is the number one revenue-generating team in any sport globally. They generated over €1 billion last year. And so basically what it means is that fan-owned and controlled clubs can be quite successful financially and still be powerhouses in the sport. Now, one of the downsides from Germany's perspective is that the private equity world has not touched Germany because they can't get in. So private equity is buying up lower division clubs in the UK and France and Spain and Italy, but not in Germany, really. But there is, however, an exception in Germany. And that is Red Bull bought a team about 10 years ago in the German fifth division, and they renamed it. And now that team is in the German first division. So there are three exceptions to the German rule about not having, you know, corporate ownership. And those three, two of those are grandfathered in, which is Wolfsburg, that's owned by Volkswagen, and then Bayer Leverkusen is owned by Bayer. Now they've got a third team that's corporate owned that's in there that's owned by Red Bull.
I'm still not clear though about the I get why the MLS ownership model as you've described it in the Football Manifesto is really a kind of enforced mediocrity because it's not really teams competing against each other with an elastic salary cap or no salary cap to put the best teams on the field and the
limitations
of people from overseas who they can sign to the clubs. But what makes fan ownership superior to, say, like, other than the moral questions, what makes fan ownership better than, say, some hyper-competitive Russian oligarch who's willing to put his family's fortune into it and lives and dies by the club?
Well, you know, I think there are a couple of things at work, and I think you have to look at the Bundesliga numbers to see it. Now, you know, when COVID came, it kind of ruined things in a sense that, you know, all the leagues got impacted dramatically. But before COVID, the Bundesliga report immediately before COVID, out of the 36 teams in the Bundesliga first division and second division, so there are 18 in each division, 34 of the 36 were in the black operationally. They have the lowest ticket prices in Europe. They have the highest attendance in Europe. And because the fans own the club, the fans frequent the club and basically play a role in the democratic running of the club administratively. So there's kind of a buy-in that you can't get with sports in the United States. Mm-hmm. That buy-in creates its own kind of culture and cohesion. And it's that culture and cohesion that's missing in the United States. I mean, you really can't have a football culture in the United States when the clubs are owned by billionaires. Mm-hmm. So for here in Brazil, for instance, Flamengo is owned by the fans. Now, obviously, as time goes by, groups form that become political inside the club to get elected who they want to be president. But aside from that, technically speaking, the club is owned by the fans. So I think in order to create a football culture in the United States, several things have to happen. One, the sport needs to be rebranded. And by that, this is, you know, no offense to your audience, but we've got to drop the word soccer. I mean, it's got to be football. And there's a history behind the word football and the word soccer in the United States. And I think actually you might have touched on this in your film Behind the Shield. The history of American football came from England, right? And it came simultaneously, quote unquote, as rugby. Mm-hmm. Rugby came to the United States in the 1860s and 70s and 80s, along with football. But football from the UK was, quote unquote, the common man's sport. Rugby was the sport of the elite in England. People at Oxford and Cambridge played rugby. It was, as they say, the comparison is gentlemen playing a hooligan's game and hooligans playing a gentleman's game. Mm. So when it came to the United States, people in the Ivy League adopted rugby as the key sport, which was quote unquote manly and quite physical and brutal as a way to indoctrinate the leadership class that the Ivy League universities were producing. And so they viewed rugby and they thought, so we've got a lock on this sport. They control people who are graduates of Harvard, who run newspapers in New York and Boston and DC and Chicago and St. Louis. And they literally came up with the idea of marketing the sport as football. Even though the numbers of people playing soccer in the United States was far greater. It was just that those were immigrants. Mm-hmm. Those were poor Irish and British and German and Italians on the Lower East Side of New York or in the outreaches of Brooklyn playing this sport. They had no financial wherewithal and they had no way to really stop the onslaught of the Ivy League motivated changes that rugby suffered. And I can't remember the name, but you will, the name of the gentleman at Yale, who yep. basically, was, what was his name?
Walter Camp.
Walter Camp, the infamous Walter Camp.
Very interesting.
Changed the rules of the game of rugby so that it became more, quote unquote, attractive. He basically invented the forward pass. And at the turn of the century, as you probably know, I think this is actually in your movie, there were a number of deaths annually
oh, yeah.
from the sport because, you know, it was literally a mini game of war.
Mm-hmm.
And so people literally died on the field. You had, you know, several dozens of people dying annually at the turn of the century. And so Walter Camp comes along and says, well, let's change the rules of the game. Teddy Roosevelt was president of the United States at the time. He was a big supporter of the sport, but he also put pressure to change the rules so that it wouldn't be, quote unquote, a killer sport. Now, obviously, fast forward and, you know, we still have people getting hurt all the time in that sport. Yeah. But nobody, thank God, has died recently.
At the pro level. I mean, the high
school. Yeah, high school level, something happens pretty much every year.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting that you say that because the earlier point, because you talked about the NFL's suppression of, let's call it football in the United States. I'm going to start saying American football and football for the purpose
Sure.
of the conversation. The NFL's suppression of football, yet it actually even predates the NFL.
Absolutely.
And I think what you say about the power of the people who played those early years of American football, the fact that they did come not just from these elite institutions, but they also approached American football with an ideology of what they wanted America,
No question.
country, to look like. So it wasn't
Absolutely.
be like this sport in soccer is a bad sport, or what they called soccer is a bad sport. It's we want to make the men of America ready to conquer the world, and we think this sport is a way to acculturate them to do that. The white men, to be clear.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I hate to say it, but it goes hand in hand with the whole theory of manifest destiny.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's, it's one hand washing the other. And of course, here we are 100 years later, more than 100 years later, and it worked out exactly as they planned. I think the challenge now is to ask ourselves whether it's, timely to start something different, to think differently. And I think that it is. I don't want to say that, that the NFL shapes consciousness, but there is no sport in the United States or globally that harkens back to military rule and structure more than the NFL. I mean, it is about as top down as you can get, from coaches calling plays on the sidelines to having, quote unquote, a field general, guiding teams down the field to conquest, as in a conquest of quote unquote land. I mean, that's what the NFL really is about. It's basically about following orders and execution, in a strict hierarchy. And of course, soccer, football, is in some sense much more like jazz or samba. I mean, it's aleatory. I mean, everybody is a field general. And it's, it's kind of like the best teams act as one mind on the field, now, having said that, the question is whether we can make that transition. I don't know. I'm certainly trying to do that. That's exactly what I'm trying to do.
I mean, I think you have a real shot at this, honestly, because, you're not only pointing out the critiques, you really are laying out what a solution could be, like the Japan model. To build that thirst in a new league, the fan ownership model, which I think would be incredibly popular, and then this idea of building that passion, which the MLS does suppress in some respects. And I'm going to ask you about the MLS in just a second, but just real quick for a clarification about fan ownership and the power that fans could have. I don't know how much you're able to follow the NBA. In Brazil, but there was recently an utterly shocking trade with Dallas trading their 25-year-old star Luka Doncic to the Lakers, to the utter shock, grief, and rage of the Dallas fan base. Now, if the Dallas Mavericks, instead of being owned by oligarch Miriam Adelson, were in fact owned by 51% by the fans, would that trade have been able to be stopped?
Exactly. Yeah, it very well may likely have been stopped. Certainly, it's interesting you say that. The way the Bundesliga is structured, like for instance, Bayern Munich. Bayern Munich is a dominant player in Germany. I'm not sure that the fans, once they lock in management, are able to interfere at managerial levels to stop, say, the sale of a player or the buying of a player. The team in Germany that in some sense suffers the most because of Bayern Munich is Borussia Dortmund. I mean, Borussia Dortmund is arguably the second most popular team in Germany. It's a huge club. They have one of the largest stadiums on the European continent. And they have an avid fan base. But one of the things that they do is serve as basically a feeder mechanism to richer clubs. And lamentably, the fans don't have much say in how that pans out. I'm not saying that the fans shouldn't have some kind of role. I think they should actually. But I think you're right about, the idea of fan-controlled clubs being able to be structured so that they would not lose not only a player, they wouldn't lose the franchise. I mean, there would be none of this stuff about, I'm going to take my franchise to Las Vegas. I mean, that kind of thing doesn't happen with fan-owned clubs. It's just out of the question. So the club is literally rooted in the community. And I
That's
think that's what's missing. If you had that, now I should also say, qualified that by saying, one of the challenges with the sport of football in the United States is rebranding. So not only do we need to call it football, but we need to rebrand it in a sense that we have to step outside the traditional branding model of the big four sports. I think one of the things that MLS and all the predecessor leagues of MLS, and including the women's league, NWSL, which is something we should talk about. Why do we have a men's league and a women's league separate from the men's league? That's another issue. But the branding that they're using is an old branding model from the big four. So there's nothing unique about any of the brands that are being created for these leagues. And as a result, it means that soccer in the United States is basically approaching the marketplace with a branding model that's already saturated. There's nothing there that attracts the fan. Obviously, there's no fan ownership, but the brands themselves are like milk toast. They have no pizzazz. There's nothing in these brands that really charges fan engagement,
Yeah.
So what I've done is to create a number of new brands for clubs that will be fan owned. And I want to share with you, just as an aside, one of the brands. And I want to pitch my GoFundMe, platform in the process.
Please do.
I've got a GoFundMe campaign that I would love to get on your podcast link. But basically, I'm going to try to tell you a story about the process that I went through in coming up with a brand. I looked at pretty much every major metropolitan area in the United States. This is an ongoing process. As I'm speaking to you, I have a bit more than 20 new brands for the sport in the United States. But I want to describe to you the process that I went through in creating a brand for the club in Boston. Now, I went to school in Boston. I know Boston very well. I spent a lot of time there. And I thought, look at the clubs that they have. I mean, you've got the Celtics, which kind of caters to the quote unquote the Irish culture that Boston represents. It's the highest per capita Irish city in the United States. You've got the New England Revolution. You've got, which is a soccer team for that Robert Kraft owns. You've got the Boston Red Sox, which has been there forever. But basically, you've got some themes around Boston that really have to do with, liberty, the revolution, things that are connected to the heritage of the United States. And I tried for literally for months and months, and I could not come up with a name for a club in Boston. But I stumbled in the course of my research on an article on Google about the history of the dispute between England and Ireland. And this is an article that was focused on the 16th century. So it's a long time ago. But the tensions between Ireland and England were so strong that the king decided that they had to do something about it in England because the Irish population in England was undermining the authority of the throne. And so they literally barred the use of the word Ireland in public conversation and in conversation inside pubs. And they posted this on placards all throughout London. You cannot use the word Ireland. So the Irish invented a new word for Ireland. And that new word is the Black Rose. And so for a while, people used the Black Rose as a synonym for Ireland. Now that's the name of the club for Boston. So that kind of thinking process, in some sense, is something that got triggered in different venues around the United States. And when you couple a good brand with fan ownership and that kind of quote unquote engagement at the community level, I think you've got a winning combination to bring a new product to the marketplace that one distinguishes the sport from the other big four and also allows you to create a new market share that didn't exist before. So that's why I think rebranding the sport is so crucial.
Tell us, please, your GoFundMe since it's on the brain right now, and let us know what the GoFundMe supports and what people who support you can perhaps get back from the GoFundMe.
Yeah, so the GoFundMe campaign right now, basically the target is to raise $100,000. You will go to the GoFundMe campaign, and that money will be used to create a Shopify store that will allow us to create kits, football kits, for each of the new clubs that are being created with these new brands. So basically, what I'm doing is repeating the Japanese model for the foundation of the J League with what we'd call, new technology and e-commerce. I'm basically going online and trying to generate enough enthusiasm online that allows fans to literally interact. It's kind of a peer-to-peer model that allows them to go in and buy quote-unquote jerseys. And at some point, we hope to have enough leverage to literally start a new league. Now, obviously, it's a big jump to go from selling t-shirts to starting a new league. But I think that the jump can be made as long as we get, a social media marketing campaign out there that's well oiled and that these brands begin to capture the imagination of fans around the country. So I think that we've got a real chance to do that. I think it's a game changer. And obviously, from our goal is to be the number one league in the United States. We would love to try to, get MLS under the umbrella of what we're doing. There will be resistance without question. But I think that MLS has done something that's interesting from a strategic standpoint. After 30 years, there is not one club in MLS that you can point to and say that it's a world-class club. Not on a revenue basis, not on a market value basis, not on any cash flow basis. So they've left literally the market for a world-class club in the United States is wide open. And the question is, who's going to fill that market? And that's the market that I'm trying to fill. We want to create at least, a dozen to 18 world-class clubs in the United States that compete on a par with the best of the clubs in Europe and Latin America.
There are a couple of MLS cities, though, that are going to find this a bitter pill to swallow. Like, I think of my, I've been to Seattle Sounders games,
Oh,
Portland
sure.
Timbers, where they do have, and I know that's, in the corner of the Pacific Northwest, and we're thinking much bigger than that. But cities like that, I think it's going, do you think it would be a bit of a bitter pill? Like, well, wait a minute, we're Sounders till we die, we're Timbers to the core, they were Thorns to the core, and now you're saying that this is not big time soccer, and now you're saying that our teams that we love are actually holding the sport back.
I think that there's a way to answer that question. I think that the enthusiasm, particularly in that Cascade area, right? The Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, I mean that kind of Cascade Cup concept, that'll be preserved. That's not going to go anywhere. I think what I'm saying is that the world classness of the sport will build on that kind of team support. So where you have that team support, that's not going to go away. That's going to stay there. I do think that in some sense, like Vancouver is called the Whitecaps. I think that that's a classic case of a club that could be rebranded and turned into quote unquote a fan-owned club. Now, whether that's something that's in the cards, we'll see. But I do believe that there are some clubs like the LAFC team in LA, which is probably I would say probably the most valuable MLS franchise today is LAFC. Forbes has them down at being valued at more than $1 billion. I'm not sure where they get that number from. I don't think it's based on cash flow or revenue. And it's certainly not based on comparables if you're comparing the value of LAFC with, say, a club in Europe. But having said that, that's a Forbes valuation. As a matter of fact, the average MLS value, according to Forbes, is about $700 million. That's amazing. I mean, it just, again, from the standpoint of traditional finance, there's no way that you can justify that valuation.
Yeah.
You can't justify it on cash flow because most of the cash flow with MLS is negative. You can't do it on revenue because if you compare it to European revenues, the top 20 clubs in revenue, they aren't even in the same ballpark. And of course, the other thing that nobody talks about are the sizes of the stadia in MLS. I mean, the average stadium size in MLS is 22,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's the size of the second division in Germany and the second division in the UK. That's not first division. That's not Man U. That's not Bayern Munich or Real Madrid. So what we're missing in the United States is that top tier of football. And I think that top tier of football has a third of the population of the United States watering in the mouth to get that kind of product. And the question is, how do you bring it to them?
Amen to that. Very well said. Yo, you've been so generous with your time, Robert Wilson. The book is called The Football Manifesto and Club Handbook, Bringing the Beautiful Game to the People and Making the USA Number One in the World. It's at all the book websites, very reasonably priced. Everybody should get it. I personally recommend bookshop.org because it draws its product directly from independent bookstores, and we support them on this show more than Jeff Bezos' conglomerate. But very much everyone should get it. Very much people should go to the GoFundMe. It will be in the description of this podcast. It will be on the nation's website along with this podcast. Can I ask you just one more fanboy question, Robert, please?
Absolutely.
All right. You lived in Brazil for the 1982 World Cup team, captained by the great Socrates, a team that did not even win the World Cup, yet might be the most storied team in the history of Brazil. Could you speak to us a little bit about what the soccer culture was like in Brazil in 1982 as Socrates' team went for it all in the shadow of a dictatorship?
Yeah, it was an amazing experience because it was the first time that I'd actually had, like literally a palpable sense of being in a country that's football crazy, right? And that team, I don't know if you've looked at any YouTube videos, that team was one of the most beautiful teams that has ever been fielded in the World Cup. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was like ballet. And they had some, I mean, the quality of the athletes. I mean, they had Falcão, they had Soccer, they had Zico. Mm-hmm. I mean, the midfield was just unbelievable. So it's a storied team even today. And I can tell you that, the dramatic exit to Italy was just traumatic mm-hmm. for the whole country. I mean, this is a country that, that lives and breathes the sport. And in 1982, amazingly enough, Brazil was still at the top of its game in terms of the world-class talent that it produced, pretty much all played in Brazil. So in a city like Rio, we have four major clubs that are the equivalent of the Yankees, the Mets, and the Dodgers in one town. And São Paulo is like that as well. So you've got that kind of competition, that level of competition, you realize that you're seeing so much talent that it's just like mind-boggling. So 1982 was like a watershed.
Yeah.
That World Cup was, first of all, the first really mega televised World Cup that happened. As you probably know, the World Cup in 78 in Argentina was somewhat tainted because of the military dictatorship. So, there's some people that think that, Peru and a few of the teams actually threw games to guarantee that Argentina would get to the final. And not only that, Holland, which is the team that Argentina met in the final, Holland had been threatened so badly in the local press that Cruyff decided not to go to the World Cup. So he was afraid to go to Argentina because he was afraid he was going to get kidnapped or killed. So Holland went, quote unquote, undermanned to the 78 World Cup. But going back to 82, I mean, it was just stunning. And what happened after 82 was just as stunning, because right after the 82 World Cup, the European clubs and basically the European leagues began raiding Argentinian and Brazilian players. And that began the mass exodus of talent from Latin America to Europe, which is still going on today. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if you look at it kind of historically speaking, it's the last remnants of European colonization. I mean, we are still sending natural resources to the rest of the world, but we're also selling human resources to Europe. It's never stopped. So European hegemony is completely dependent on talent from Africa and Latin America.
Wow.
And so that trend in 1982 began literally a tidal wave of talent exodus from Brazil.
Amazing. Hey, Robert Wilson, thank you so much for joining us here on the Edge of Sports podcast.
Dave, it's been great, man. I've loved it, every minute of it. Love to get back with you at some point.
Oh, yeah. No, I'd love that in the future. If nothing else, we can check in on the progress of what's happening. Yeah, I want to thank The Nation Magazine, the sponsor of this podcast. I want to thank my producer, David Tigaboo, who does an amazing job always. Big shout out, if we could, to the book, The Football Manifesto, which everybody should check out. So for everybody out there, all you Edge of Sporters listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.